3 hours universal time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Iran claims it launched 2 ballistic test missiles Wednesday, purportedly inscribing them in Hebrew with a message against Israel. The semi-official Fars News agency showed pictures it said were of Qadr H missiles being fired from a western, or rather eastern, mountain range in Iran. Their target, 1,400 kilometers away off the country's coast into the Sea of Oman. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby.
We condemn all threats to Israel, and we'll stand with Israel to help it defend itself against all kinds of threats.
According to one of the leaders of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the reason they designed their missiles with a range of 2,000 kilometers is to be able to hit the enemy, the Zionist regime, from a safe distance, and described the tests as a show of it. Deterrent power. The visit of Vice President Joe Biden to Israel and the Palestinian territories is being overshadowed by violence. Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
Vice President Joe Biden criticized the Palestinian Authority for remaining silent after a Palestinian went on a stabbing rampage Tuesday near Tel Aviv. An American tourist was killed and 10 other people were wounded.
The United States of America condemns these acts and condemns the failure to condemn these acts.
The ruling Palestinian Fatah Party praised the attack, part of a wave of almost daily Palestinian stabbings, shootings, and car rammings. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Also today, an Islamic State operative suspected of being the head of the militant group's chemical weapon program is reported in custody, captured last week. This is VOA News. In the second significant U.S. attack on al-Shabaab in 5 days, U.S. and Somali forces have attacked a militant base west of Mogadishu. A U.S. official confirms the raid was a joint U.S.-Somali government operation. A Somali official said helicopters dropped between 60 and 70 soldiers outside the town of Oud Heghel just after midnight. The official, Mohammed Awais Abukar, told VOA the troops then attacked 3 or 4 targets in the town, inflicting a number of casualties on the militants. Al-Shabaab said one of its fighters was killed in the raid, while others forced the troops into retreat. Last Saturday, U.S. aircraft fired missiles at an Al-Shabaab training camp north of Mogadishu, killing 150 militants, according to the Pentagon. Al-Shabaab confirmed the aerial attack, but said the death toll was exaggerated. United Nations Syrian envoy Staffan de Mistura says substantive talks on a political transition in Syria begin Monday and will not last beyond March 24th. He commented from Geneva today as the second round of proximity talks between the Syrian government and the opposition formally opened without the key players who have not yet arrived. When talks are underway, the focus will be on new governance, constitutions, and elections, the future elections, in 18 months' time, according to de Mistura. In a statement to VOA, the main Syrian opposition group said it would be a no-show for today's discussions because they're still discussing whether they'll attend. The Syrian government also indicated it would not join until later, an indication that proximity talks may not be fully underway until March 14th. Meantime, thousands of migrants from Syria and other countries are now stranded in Greece, blocked from their goal of reaching northern Europe after Macedonia closed its border today. Macedonian police shut the border one day after Slovenia, Croatia, and Serbia declared their borders closed to almost all transiting migrants, with exceptions being made only for asylum seekers. The actions effectively closed the so-called Balkan route many migrants have taken to reach wealthier nations in Western Europe. Slovenian Prime Minister Miro Cerar said the Balkan route for illegal immigration no longer exists. Authorities say nearly 36,000 migrants and refugees are stranded in Greece with more than 14,000, mainly Syrian and Iraqi nationals, stuck in a sprawling muddy camp near a border crossing into Macedonia. Also today, the former drummer of Beatles, Ringo Starr, has announced the death of the so-called fifth Beatle, producer George Martin, at age 90. Starr posted the news on Twitter with a photograph of Martin, thanking him for all his love and kindness. British Prime Minister David Cameron also attributed a tweet. I'm Marty Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. From the Voice of America, I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Lawyers challenging the re-election of Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni say police broke into their offices and stole computers and documents.
It's the police that broke into the chambers of my lawyers. It was police in uniform, police in civilian clothes, and the military as well. So it was a big force.
That's former Ugandan Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi. A global gathering of scientists say the next Einstein will come from Africa. Rights activists in Zimbabwe protest the disappearing of fellow activist Itai Zamora. And Switzerland agrees to repatriate public money stolen by former Nigerian military ruler Sani Abacha.
It's quite an interesting incident. But at a time when our reserves are really going down and there is a yearning for more and more cash, that the Swiss Federation is delivering this windfall, returning Abacha looted funds.
Galba Shehu is the Special Assistant on Media and Publicity to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. A new study shed more light on the behavior of chimpanzees in Guinea-Bissau, and a new treatment strategy prevents malaria in pregnant women. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's Sports and our Listener of the Day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former Ugandan Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi says Ugandan police Wednesday broke into the offices of his lawyers, making away with computers and documents containing affidavits of witnesses about electoral malpractices in Uganda. Mr. Mbabazi is challenging in the Ugandan Supreme Court the re-election of President Yoweri Museveni. The Ugandan police said in a statement on Wednesday that they have instituted a composite team to actively and thoroughly investigate the alleged break-ins. Ugandan government spokesman Ofwando Opondo says the suspected break-ins could be an insider job for propaganda value. U.S. Ambassador to Uganda Deborah Malak has reportedly called for a thorough investigation of the alleged break-ins. Mr. Mbabazi said he's certain that the Ugandan police were behind the break-ins because at least four witnesses saw them.
It's the police that broke into the chambers of my lawyers. I know it was police because there were at least four eyewitnesses. It was police in uniform, police in civilian clothes, and the military as well. So it was a big force.
So what do you suspect the police were looking for?
We were using these two chambers as the workplaces for preparing our evidence for the petition against the election of the president. And they took all the affidavits, which were in the chambers. They took all the computers, and they literally carried away everything that had any information relating to the petition.
Have you gone to the police to complain about what you are claiming happened?
Well, one of the chambers where the police was in uniform, the staff there were very clear that it was the police, so there was no point of going to police to report to them what they had done because everybody knew it was the police involved. Today was the last day that the Supreme Court gave the petitioner to file his evidence. I was supposed to file all my evidence today.
That's exactly what I want to ask you. What impact do you think it might have on your case?
First of all, it meant that we were not able to meet the Supreme Court deadline of filing our evidence today. And although we'll be going there tomorrow, essentially for a conferencing meeting, it will be very clear that we will have failed to meet that deadline because the evidence had been taken away by the police.
Is it possible it could hurt in terms of who your witnesses might be? Because if your lawyers had information on witnesses, those witnesses can also be affected or intimidated once they are apparently known.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Of course, I should have told you that the police has been arresting our witnesses. They've been intimidating anyone who has indicated willingness to give us evidence about malpractice during this election. Even today, many were arrested. And of course, the other day, they arrested 14 who are coming in to give evidence. Our suspicion is that they will be intimidating and arresting all the witnesses whose list is now in their possession.
Are you still going to go to the Supreme Court today, Thursday?
Yes, we go to the Supreme Court. And we did raise this question of intimidation of our witnesses the last time the Supreme Court sat. And we would like to appeal to the court to prevail on the executive to stop this intimidation, to stop this interference. Because if they don't, then obviously they will have successfully frustrated the petition.
Honorable Mbabazi, it's always nice to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, James.
That was former Ugandan Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Switzerland soon will repatriate about $321 million to Nigeria following an agreement between the governments in Abuja and Geneva, according to Nigerian presidential spokesman Garba Shehu. The agreement was signed on Tuesday by Nigeria's Attorney General Abubakar Malami and Switzerland's foreign minister. The money represents what's left from funds that former military ruler Sani Abacha stashed away in Swiss banks. Shehu tells reporter Peter Clotty that President Muhammadu Buhari is winning the confidence of the international community to help Nigeria recover public funds siphoned out of the country.
It is a happy development. The Nigerian government has been on these issues for quite a while, and it's quite an interesting incident. But at a time when our reserves are really going down and there is a yearning for more and more cash, that the Swiss Federation is delivering this windfall, returning Abacha looted funds, $321 million.
So when tentatively do you know Switzerland will make these funds available to Nigeria?
Well, I imagine it will be as soon as possible because the agreement that had been signed, of course, elicited assurances from the Nigerian government that the money to be gotten back will be put to use in the best interest of Nigeria. I think that over the past, and this is what has delayed the recovery of looted assets, is that money recovered from countries such as Switzerland, money was re-looted. So the people who got back the money pocketed and then didn't inspire the confidence of the international community in order to, you know, to continue to help Nigeria recover the stolen assets. Here we are under a new administration that places a lot of premium on openness, on transparency, accountability under President Muhammadu Buhari. And we are beginning to elicit the right kind of responses from the international community.
Some Nigerians have demanded more action on looted funds out of the country, particularly when Switzerland has finally decided to repatriate over $300 million back to Nigeria. What about all the funds that previous officials have allegedly siphoned out of the country?
Well, you know, two things here. One is that, you know, that the recovery of stolen assets such as we are dealing with does not itself come easy, because it will require a lot of processes, sometimes going through the court systems of the countries that are involved. You know, their banking, insurance companies. Above all, the political will to even let go. Because to be honest with you, some of the countries, they enjoy this money also being in their own countries, in their own systems. So they don't want to just let go. So it will take a political will on the part of the leaders of some of these countries to allow this money to come.
Garba Shehu is the Special Assistant on Media and Publicity to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 10th. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Human rights activists in Zimbabwe on Wednesday commemorated the one-year anniversary of the disappearance of fellow political activist Itai Zamara. Sebastian Mofu has the story for VOA from Harare.
Marchers marking the one-year anniversary of Itai Zamara's disappearance called for the return of the activist and journalist who was abducted after a series of demonstrations against the rule of President Robert Mugabe. Former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai addressed the activists.
Itai Zamara's disappearance represents the unacceptable face of this regime, the unacceptable face of a government that just embarks on abducting people just because they have a different view.
The March Wednesday only materialized after activists took the government to court for initially barring the protest. Police maintained a heavy presence, but that did not deter activists from singing, accusing Mugabe's government of continuing to disrespect human rights, as Zamara used to say before he vanished last March. Human rights lawyers say the government has not complied with the High Court order compelling security forces, including the police, to look for him, but Sherid Sharamba, the Zimbabwe police spokeswoman, dismissed the accusation.
When people are not informed, they are bound to come up with certain perceptions. In actual fact, we've been doing quite a lot behind the scenes to establish who could have abducted him and where is he. But we have failed so far. But still, we are appealing to information from anybody else who might have knowledge of where Itai Dzamara is.
Itai Dzamara's brother, Patterson, says he's skeptical of the police version.
For them to actually fail to come up with at least just but one explanation, that is very curious. It only cements our suspicion, what we believe happened. It is the police, it is the state security agents. Whether this was sanctioned from the top or its elements within the system, but it's boiling down to one thing. The system is responsible. ZANU-PF and state security agents are responsible for this.
Activists accuse the Mugabe government of not putting enough effort into finding Dzamara. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The next Einstein will come from Africa. That is the premise of a global gathering of scientists, government representatives, and innovators in Senegal this week. Alpha Diallo reports for VOA from Dakar.
The organizers of the next Einstein Forum say sub-Saharan Africa contribute just 1% of the world's scientific research output. That is not for lack of ingenuity, but rather lack of opportunity. Senegalese President Macky Sall and his Rwandan counterpart Paul Kagame opened the forum in Dakar with pledges to invest more in scientific education and research. In recent years, both countries have opened specialized institutions for science, math, and technology. Flavia Segel is UNESCO's Undersecretary General for the Natural Sciences. She says brain drain is a problem.
Well, I think if Africa and African countries like Senegal or Rwanda explain today can actually bring a future to young people, opportunities for good professional careers, I would say these young people either would not leave or they will come back again to be reunited with their families and friends in their home countries.
Scientists who remain in Africa encounter daily challenges. Ghanaian researcher Victor Osei is participating in the forum.
If you're a scientist doing a science project, you obviously need certain things to be available, the least of which probably is something like electricity. I can't imagine a science research project that has to be stopped because there's no good supply of electricity, for instance. So these are all things that when we talk about the enabling environment, we need to think about.
Organizers of the forum say today the continent loses out on about $4 billion each year when Africans go abroad for jobs in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. But the managing director of the next Einstein Forum, Arun Sama, says Africa is poised for a scientific boom.
I think there's also a huge amount of political will which is now coming up, and it's clear that the politicians, not all the politicians, but many of the decision makers, are recognizing the necessity for science and technology to be a driver for Africa.
Sama says the goal of this week's forum is to showcase the work of young African scientists and help connect them with opportunities for education and funding. Alpha Diallo for VOA News, Dakar.
In the malaria-endemic countries of Africa, it's not uncommon for pregnant women to become infected with the mosquito-borne parasite. The disease puts newborns at risk of death, but a new prevention strategy offers hope that expectant mothers will be able to deliver healthy babies, VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
The risk of pregnant women becoming infected with malaria is very high in developing African countries. Researchers say 60% of women who showed up to be recruited for a prevention study had evidence of the parasite. Malaria is responsible for more than 100,000 newborns' death in sub-Saharan Africa each year. The disease can also cause infants to be born prematurely or at low birth weight, both of which are risk factors for newborn mortality. So pregnant women in malaria-endemic regions are urged to sleep under insecticide-treated bed nets. Many also receive the inexpensive drug combination sulvodoxine pyrimethamine, recommended by the World Health Organization to protect against malaria. That was once the standard treatment for the disease, but the malaria parasite has become largely resistant to those drugs, according to Grant Dorsey, an infectious diseases specialist at the University of California, San Francisco.
We abandoned it, over a decade ago for treatment because of resistance. However, we're still using it to prevent malaria in pregnant women. So that was the kind of rationale behind our study, was that we felt that this drug currently being recommended to prevent malaria in pregnancy may not be working.
So researchers have been experimenting with an artemisinin-based therapy called dihydroartemisinin piperaquine. In a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine, Dorsey and colleagues report that treatment with the drug combination dramatically reduced the risk of malaria in a group of 300 Ugandan women, none of whom was infected when the study began. Some women were given three doses over their pregnancy, others received it monthly. A third group got the standard treatment.
The risk of being infected with malaria during pregnancy was reduced to 17%. And then if we gave the drug once a month, it was 5%. So just the risk of having malaria parasites at any time during pregnancy went from 40% to 17% down to 5%.
In other words, there was a dramatic reduction of malaria infection in the women who got the artemisinin-based drug compared to those who received the standard care drug treatment. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
A group of local and international researchers recently announced that chimpanzees in Guinea-Bissau have shown startling new behavior that has never before been detected among the animals. Specifically, the animals sometimes threw rocks at trees, creating piles of stones in a tree hollow. The actions could be a form of communication, or it could be ritualistic and a way of marking territory. And Marie Goldmakers, president of Chimpo, the team conducting the study in Guinea-Bissau, explains to Ricky Stryak the importance of these discoveries.
The local population points out certain information on chimpanzee behavior that they think is normal, but is new compared to the data we know about chimpanzees.
What is that behavior, and why is it new and possibly exciting in this field?
It started in 2012 when one of our local guides pointed to a tree. The outer side of the tree was damaged, and he showed how it was done. It was done by chimpanzees, and they knocked on the tree. And his explanation was that it was to communicate with other chimpanzees. And for him, it was quite normal behavior. And he pointed out several trees like that. We put cameras at some of those trees. We saw chimpanzees that threw stones, that not only knocked with stones on the trees, but also threw stones at the trees, and even made piles of stones in a hollow tree or near the tree or at the foot of the tree. So together we in 2013, 2013-2014, we ran a large research program. We focused our research on this behavior, and together we wrote a large article. And this might be a very early, not really early for the chimpanzee, but could be compared to the early behavior of humans in a kind of indicated sacred sites or as a start of religious sites, etc.
If that's true, it's the first time that this has been observed in chimps, correct? That it could be a ritualistic.
Yeah, absolutely. It has been found, and they have 39 sites in which they do the same type of research. We have one of the sites in Boy. They found this behavior in four sites, and one of the sites was our site, is Boe. This seems to be the most important site with the best pictures and the most often observed behavior like this. So if this behavior has a communication purpose, then this will be certainly affected chimpanzees in a negative way, apart from all the other negative effects of bauxite mining.
That was Anne-Marie Goldmakers, president of Chimpo. She was speaking to Ricky Strijek from the Netherlands. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Marco Woman in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on football. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, Secretary General Hicham El Amrani says they have thrown their full weight behind the Zimbabwe Football Association, ZIFA's, move to stamp out match fixing in some of their upcoming international competitions. ZIFA President Philip Chiyangwa told the Harare media on Wednesday that they have suspended ZIFA committee member Edzai Kasinauyo and assistant national team coach Nation Dube over alleged match-fixing as part of an ongoing investigation. Chiyangwa reckons they have strong evidence of wrongdoing, which they will forward to CAF and FIFA for further action. On a more cheerful note, Angola is determined to qualify for the Futsal World Cup in Colombia later this year. To achieve this, they must place among the top three at the Africa Futsal Championships in Johannesburg, South Africa next month. Angola start their Group B campaign against Morocco, then Africa's top side Egypt and the 2008 Africa Champions Libya. Speaking through an interpreter, I asked Angola's coach Libanya Lopez what he makes of the draws.
É uma série bastante difícil, é a série da morte, mas é a nossa sorte.
Okay, it's a very difficult group actually, but that is a group that we are. So we are prepared for that. Very difficult. We don't have to choose the adversaries. We have to play. We recently was prepared in Brazil with one of the best teams in the world. And definitely we're going to fight and make it.
Angola played at the last Futsal World Cup, and you see they have to fight Egypt, the best team, and Libya, the defending champions. Is there any target? What is the target for the Angola team?
Angola is coming to South Africa futsal competition to actually qualify for the World Cup. Angola is in this group, Libya, Morocco. Actually, we're going to face them, but our main purpose is to qualify for the World Cup.
That was Libanya Lopez, the Angola men's futsal national team coach, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good day. That's it for this Thursday, March 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Strijek, as well as sports editor Mark Owoman, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good Thursday.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. tune in. Feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.